There's a story, I think, apocryphal story about some South London gangsters. And as is often the way with gangsters, they love the appearance of respectability. And so they made sure they were regular churchgoers and they were all the right occasions, especially community occasions. And anyway, when the older brother died, the younger brother went around with their bodyguard, their henchman, to visit the local vicarage. And he explained to the vicar not only that he wanted the vicar to conduct the brother's funeral, but that he wanted the vicar's funeral address to describe this older brother as a total saint. And the vicar obviously was not very happy. He said that he had to be directed by his conscience. He could only speak the truth about this older brother, at which point the henchman started getting up in his seat and looking aggressive. And the younger brother kind of held the henchman back and said, "Well, don't worry, I'm sure the vicar doesn't want any trouble. I'm sure he will describe my vicar, my brother, as a total saint, or we'll be calling again." Anyway, the day of the funeral comes round and the vicar, true to his word, doesn't hold back. And he says, "Look, we all know the man we're burying today. He was a bully. He cheated on his wife. He intimidated everyone who got into his way." And after a few minutes going on like this, the vicar caught the eye of the younger brother and he realised that he needed to say what he needed. And he remembered their conversation and he concluded his address by saying this: "But despite all I've said, we must remember that compared to his brother, he was a total saint." And then he sat down. And the reason I begin with this slightly silly story is that I have talked to enough people, maybe you have, and I've been to enough funerals, especially as a minister, to know that a lot of people assume in life that in the final analysis, when all is said and done, when we get to the end of our lives, we can airbrush our lives. If there is a God, surely I will be okay, we think. If I've muddled through life okay, surely I'll be able to muddle through death and judgment. After all, isn't God a God of love? Who's to say what level of good is good enough? I've always done my best. I've never done anyone any harm, or at least most of us think we've never done anyone any serious harm. And it's a good question. It's the question we're going to be thinking about today, is this question of how can I tell if I'm okay with God? In one sense, whatever else is going on in the world, can there be a more important question than this question, given that we're all going to die and face God one day? How can I tell if I'm okay with God? Now, that question will be a very pressing issue for some of us. And yet, I guess for others of us, if we know the Bible and we've become committed believers, we probably know what the Bible's answer is to that question. And perhaps for us, the more pressing issue is that we know folk who adopt this "I will muddle through" mentality to life and to death. And we know these people, and these are people whom we know are sleepwalking into disaster, spiritually speaking. And because we love these people, we would love to know how to help them. So whichever our situation is, whether this is our own issue or those around us and we want to help them, this passage is going to be a great help to us as we think about this topic. How can we know if we're right with God? And just to tell you where we're going, I'm going to tell you we've got 2 points today, and they are these: God has fully endorsed Jesus. And the second point is, so our response to Jesus is our response to God. It's the only thing that matters, is how we respond to Jesus. So that's where we're heading. That's the map. But I'm going to slow down and we're going to go slowly through the verses we looked at and see how Peter, who was preaching in that reading, argues this case in more detail. Now, just to recap where we've got to, we've been going through Acts week by week, and this is the third of 5 sermons on Acts chapter 2. It's the day of Pentecost. And the Jerusalem crowd who are gathered on this kind of harvest festival are from, there's thousands of people from all over the world who are gathered together. And an incredible thing happened on the day of Pentecost. And there were these extraordinary miracles. They heard a sound like a rushing wind. They saw tongues of fire rest on Jesus' disciples. And most extraordinary for them, they witnessed Jesus' disciples speaking the praises of God in unlearned languages. The Arabs heard it in Arabic, the Egyptians heard it in Coptic, and so on. Dozens of languages from all around the world. And if you were here last week, we heard, and I gave a little bit of the run into this passage, we heard Peter stand up and explain what these miracles mean, what is going on. And he said, look, this is what the Bible prophesied. The prophet Joel said that in the last days, God would pour out his Holy Spirit. And now is the time of salvation. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. And of course, this crowd are very devout. They're scrupulous about the Bible. They're meticulous about obeying God. And they're all at a religious festival, which some of them have traveled halfway around the world to get to. So if you think about it, if anyone in the world would have felt that they had good reason to think they are okay with God, that they're in God's good books, that there'll be those who are going to muddle through, surely it would be this crowd. And that is why Peter, one of Jesus' disciples, he spends his time in the sermon focusing in on Jesus. And he focuses in on this question of who is Jesus and how have we responded to him? And Peter begins by arguing, as I've mentioned, that God has fully endorsed Jesus. God could not have made it clearer that Jesus is right at the center of God's purposes. Now, if you know the events surrounding Jesus' life, you will know that Jesus did many public miracles. He calmed a storm. He healed all the sick in a particular area. He raised the dead. He multiplied food for vast crowds of people and so on. And you will know that at the time, there was much discussion about where Jesus could have got this power from. Some people were saying, you know, maybe he's in league with the devil. Is that where the power's from? But if you know the accounts, you will also know that no one at the time questioned the reality of Jesus' miracles. They just couldn't do that. There was no escaping the fact that something extraordinary was going on. And this is what Peter reminds the crowd about in this sermon. So let's pick up from the beginning, verse 22. Peter says, "Men of Israel, hear these words." Let me make it a little bit bigger. "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know." So God's view of Jesus, Peter says, is obvious. Everyone here knows about it. We can all testify to the reality of these miracles. There's no denying them. And that, of course, was part of the point of Jesus' miracles. It was so that everyone would know this guy has God's endorsement. So that people like, if you know John's Gospel, chapter 3, the chief rabbi, Nicodemus, he comes round to Jesus' house at night and he says, "Look, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these miracles unless God is with him." It was obvious to everyone. That much is clear. God is definitely giving you his full backing, Nicodemus says. You've totally got God's endorsement. So now tell us the rest. Who are you? What have you come to do? But that much we've got. God is behind what you're doing. But, Peter says, there is a problem. So God is clearly totally behind Jesus. And yet he asks this crowd, "But what about you? Are you behind Jesus?" Sometimes in a drama, TV drama or something, the hero is hurrying to their first day of a new job. And they're in such a hurry to get to their new job that they end up cutting up someone in the traffic, only to discover when they get to the new job that the person they cut up was their new boss. And so they arrive in real trouble. That's how the Jack Ryan series begins. But imagine if you had not just kind of cut someone up in traffic, but you'd done something worse. You'd bullied someone. Let's say you'd bullied someone at school, and then you discovered that this person was the headmaster's son. And you think, "Oh no, what have I done?" Or worse than that, imagine if you'd been bullying someone, but the person you'd been bullying wasn't the headmaster's son, but the Son of God. Or worse still, and this is actually the realization that this crowd are going through, Imagine if not just bullying, but they had killed the Son of God. And now they're going to discover what a terrible thing they've done. What then? That's the situation this crowd are in. And so Peter continues, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, the man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men, by the Romans." And this crowd must be putting one and one together, and they're thinking, "Oh my word, what has happened? What have we done? I cannot see any scenario where this is going to end well." And Peter carries on and he ends his sermon with almost the same line. This is the line that we began with, do you remember? "Let all the house of Israel therefore know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified." But before he concludes his sermon like that, Peter, in the middle of the sermon, he includes two more arguments. And these arguments actually just pile it on and make things even worse for his hearers. And the two arguments he includes, we're going to run through them, are in dark blue there. That Easter, the events of Easter, the resurrection of Jesus, proves that God raised Jesus as the Christ. We'll explain what that means, the conquering eternal king. And second, that Pentecost proves that God exalted Jesus as the Lord, the sovereign ruler of the universe. And just like with his argument from Joel 2, Peter uses the Old Testament to back up his arguments. And we're going to look at these arguments, one and then the other, now. So let's look at the first one. Easter proves that God raised Jesus as the Christ. Excuse me. Now, Peter begins now by proclaiming what he and all the other apostles have witnessed. It's in verse 24, and he says this: God raised Jesus up. God raised Jesus up. But Peter doesn't just want to tell them the fact of Jesus' resurrection, which they've all seen. He wants to explain the meaning of Jesus' resurrection. And the meaning of Jesus' resurrection is that God was confirming Jesus as the Christ. God was declaring to the whole world that this guy is the conquering eternal king. This is the one who was promised in the scriptures. And the way Peter shows this is he goes back to the Old Testament, and specifically Psalm 16, that was written 1,000 years before by King David. And in this psalm, King David writes about how the Messiah, his relationship with God will be so strong that it will eventually outlast death. And so the one who's beaten death, therefore, must be the Messiah. That's the logic. This is a pretty popular idea in fiction, the idea that a relationship can be so strong that it outlasts death. You see this kind of idea in Beauty and the Beast. Belle's relationship with the beast is so strong it brings the beast back from death and transforms him into the prince. Or you see it in the 90s film Ghost, where the love relationship between the Patrick Swayze character and the Demi Moore character is so strong it endures beyond death. And there's lots of examples. My favourite is The Princess Bride, and it's the same thing that's being communicated. But these fictional stories speak better than they know, because David says that the Messiah's relationship with God, because God himself is stronger than death, that relationship will be so strong that it will mean the Messiah will outlast death. And this is how David argues it in Psalm 16. For David says concerning him, this is David says concerning the Christ, and he's speaking actually in the first person as I, but he's speaking ultimately about the Christ. And he says, "I saw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. My flesh also will dwell in hope, for you will not abandon my soul to Hades or let your Holy One see corruption. You have made known to me the paths of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence." I'm going to boost my hay fever levels. Excuse me. My antihistamine levels. That might help. So David predicted in this psalm that God's relationship with the Messiah is going to be so strong that God would not let his Holy One, that's a title for the Messiah, remain dead. And just in case anyone in the crowd was thinking, hang on a minute, how do we know David in that psalm was speaking about the Messiah, not about himself, because he does say I, Peter says, and this is verse 29, brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David that he both died and was buried and his tomb is with us to this day. So he's saying, look, come with me. We're in Jerusalem. Let's go and see David's tomb. His bones are going to be 1,000 years old now, but David's presence in that tomb proves, doesn't it, that Psalm 16 wasn't ultimately about David. It was always David looking forward to the Holy One, the Messiah. And then he says, verse 30, David, being therefore a prophet and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, the Messiah, that he, the Christ, was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. Now, even if you haven't followed all the detail there, the big point in this section Peter is making is that Jesus is alive. We all witnessed that. And Jesus' resurrection has a meaning. It's not just some quirky fact of history, some weird miracle God happened to do. No, Easter, Jesus' resurrection, proves God raised Jesus as the Christ. The resurrection of Jesus is God's declaration to the world that this guy, this person, is the one I have chosen as king. He is the one who is going to rule over the nations eternally, just as the scriptures said. That's the true meaning of Easter. Now, I want us just to pause there and think about this question. Is someone coming back from the dead good news or bad news? How would you answer that question? And I think you would say it depends. That it does depend, doesn't it? It depends on the situation. When Lazarus, Jesus' friend, when Jesus called him out of the tomb, his sisters were just overjoyed and they held a dinner party to celebrate and Jesus was guest of honor and it was a wonderful day. But let's say that the one who's walking out of the tomb is the one we have really upset. We've ignored them, we've rejected them, or even for these guys in the crowd, we've crucified them. Well, that person coming back from the dead, that is a very different question, especially if the one walking out of the tomb has now been given divine authority to judge his enemies. This is actually, if you know the Bible, this is kind of what happened earlier in the Bible to Joseph's brothers back in Genesis. Do you remember they'd sold their brother Joseph into slavery? And I guess that was the end of him. They just assumed he'd gone and died in Egypt. But then suddenly, and this is, you know, years and years later, they found themselves standing before him, actually bowing before him. This man they thought was dead, and now here he is. And he's been made ruler of the known world. He's been given sovereign power to do with them exactly as he pleases. And suddenly, this return becomes a very frightening prospect. So is someone coming back from the dead good news or bad news? Well, it depends. Easter is two-edged, isn't it? How you and I should feel about Easter depends on how we're relating to Jesus. Okay, let's keep going. So Peter continues next with the next plank of his argument. Not only does Easter prove God raised Jesus as the Christ, but the second argument, Pentecost, the miracles they've seen that day, proves God exalted Jesus as the Lord. And this is what Peter explains next. So this is actually where Peter comes full circle in a way. So the whole reason Peter's making this speech in Jerusalem is because everyone in the crowd has just witnessed these incredible Pentecost miracles, the sound, the tongues of fire, the unlearned languages. And Peter says, what you have witnessed today, this is the proof, not simply that Jesus is the king, the Christ, But Pentecost is the proof that Jesus has been made the sovereign Lord of the universe. So follow Peter's argument here in verse 32. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses. He's already covered that. Being therefore exalted at the right hand of God, we looked in Acts 1, Jesus was raised up to heaven, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he, Jesus, has poured out this that you yourselves are seeing and hearing. So what is the deepest explanation for the Pentecost miracles and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit? What's really behind what was happening that day? And there's lots of answers we can give. It's a reversal of the Babel rebellion. We thought about that 2 weeks ago. It's a sign that God has launched the reunification of all the people groups in the world. What else? Well, it's also a sign that we have entered the last days. We saw this last week, if you were with us. This is the sign that God has opened the window of opportunity, and now everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That's what Pentecost means. But perhaps the deepest explanation of what Pentecost means, and what has actually triggered these events at this particular time, is that Pentecost is all to do with Jesus. In particular, Pentecost proves that Jesus has been raised up to rule this universe. That is an incredible reality. Like, just imagine if you could make a short list now of people in history who have been given authority to pour out God's Spirit on this world and to unlock God's salvation purposes on this planet. You write out the short list and you discover it is very short. There is only one person on that list. He's in a league of his own. And the fascinating thing is that this is an authority which was given to Jesus at a certain moment in history after his resurrection. That's why the risen Jesus, as he ascends into heaven, he declares to his disciples, this is a famous verse at the end of Matthew's gospel, sometimes called the Great Commission. What does he say? He says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, Jesus said. It happened when he was raised from the dead. Well, some people say, well, why did Jesus need to receive authority? It's a strange thing, isn't it? Surely as the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, hasn't he always had divine authority? Hasn't Jesus had authority even before there was a creation? And the answer is yes. Yes, the Son of God has always been Lord of the universe. And we see that in Jesus' life. You know, when he calms the storm with just a word, the wind and the waves are responding to the voice that created them. That's how authoritative Jesus was before his resurrection. But, and here's the amazing thing that we're thinking about today. After Jesus' resurrection, as the crucified and risen one, Jesus is now installed in a new office as Lord and Christ, Lord and Messiah. In fact, he has an authority greater, if you can believe it, than the authority he exercised before. And we're thinking, what? How can that be? How can Jesus have even greater authority than he had before? And the answer is because it's only on the basis of his dying and rising again that he has authority to forgive sins. It's only as the risen Christ that he can now release people from the power of sin and the world and the devil and grant them eternal life and establish one day a new creation. If you think about it, if Christ had not died, if Christ had not been raised from the dead, he would actually lack the authority to do those things. There would be no salvation. He would not hold the office of saving Lord over creation. So yes, of course, there were people who received forgiveness before then, through the sacrificial system in Israel, and also when Christ declared forgiveness over people during his earthly ministry. But they were like checks which were written out that only had validity because of something that was coming after the death and resurrection of Christ. And now that that has come, Jesus is raised at God's right hand with a new office. And we mentioned Hitton gave a little intro to this, and Philip read a passage from Revelation chapter 5 in our first reading. And that passage really helpfully communicates the change which happened after Jesus' resurrection. So in John's vision, John sees a scroll, you remember, which represents all the plans God has for his creation. And the mighty angel proclaims in a loud voice, this is in heaven, who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? Who has authority to execute God's great plans for his creation? And you'll remember John weeps because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll. And then, and this is the drama of it, then one of the elders says, this is Revelation 5:5, do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals. And we see there that it's on the basis of Jesus' victory, his triumph, that he now receives, he's now qualified to receive a new authority. And this triumph that is described in this verse, we're told in verse 9 of the same chapter, is the triumph is Jesus's death. It's the triumph by which he purchased for God people from every tribe, language, people and nation. So whilst Jesus has always had authority as our creator, this office as saving Lord is something which is new and which he only received after his resurrection. And one of the evidences for Jesus being crowned as the saving Lord, Peter says in verse 33, is that Jesus has just poured out his spirit. Pentecost proves that God exalted Jesus as Lord. Well done if you've stuck with that. There's some detailed arguments, and do read it again if you were struggling with the logic there. The big point here, we began by asking the question at the beginning, how can I tell if I'm okay with God? And the answer of this passage is quite simple. Well, look at Jesus. God has fully endorsed Jesus. God has put all his eggs in the Jesus basket. God has said, I am behind Jesus. And that is why, of course, and this is much, much more brief, we're going to look at it as our final point. Therefore, our response to Jesus is our response to God. Nothing could matter more than the way you and I respond to Jesus. Now, if we were to do a word association game, let's say on the street in our society, for the word Easter, you say, what does it make you think of? Let's do it with Easter, not Pentecost, because a lot of people wouldn't know what Pentecost is. But you say, what does Easter make you think of? And I think the words that would jump out would be things like cute bunnies or chocolate eggs, something like that. Or if someone, you know, you chanced across someone who was a Christian, they'd probably give something like the word hope or the word life or something like that. And that's true. Easter does bring resurrection hope and life, eternal life. But I hope we can see from this passage that these are not the associations that the first hearers would have thought of. You see, for Peter, he wants his hearers to think Easter, think Jesus' universal lordship. Or think Easter, think judgment. Actually, that's how Easter is preached later on in Acts. For example, in Acts 17, think Easter, think judgment. That's the first association Peter wants us to have in our minds. So we come back to this question, is Easter good news? Is it good news? Well, it depends. It's like asking, was D-Day good news? That day when the Allied forces began the liberation of Western Europe. Well, it depends. It depends which side you're on. Was Nelson Mandela's release from prison in 1990 good news? Well, it depends. It depends if you were on the side of apartheid or on the side of Mandela. That's the point about Easter. Easter declares everything has now changed. And there is now no place for neutrality. There's no place for someone to be a spiritual fence sitter. Easter means the time of decision has come. And that now our response to Jesus is our response to God. Nothing could matter more. Wonderfully, this world is not meaningless. We were thinking about this last week. We don't live in a soap opera where everything just rumbles on. We live in a story. It has a meaning. It has an end point. There will be a judgment. There will be a final accounting. And one day each one of us will stand before our Maker. And the question is not going to be, have you tried to muddle through? The question is not going to be, have you tried not to harm others too much across your lifespan? No, the question is going to be, what have you done with Jesus? What have we done with Jesus? Jesus is not a swear word. He's not just an inconvenience. Jesus is the sovereign Lord of the universe. And the question is, have we gladly accepted Jesus' lordship? And have we received the pardon, the mercy which he offers? Or have we stuck our fingers up at him and kept him at arm's length and tried to ignore him? The point is that our response to Jesus is our response to God. We asked the question at the beginning, how we might help people who are unaware, who are kind of sleepwalking into disaster, spiritually speaking. And it's the same answer. We need to cut to the chase. We need to ask people, can I ask you what you make of Jesus? What is it about Jesus perhaps that you find unpersuasive? Maybe you've never thought about it. Or perhaps you've never looked at the life of Jesus at all. Perhaps we could look at the accounts together. Why don't we read it together? Because the truth is, how we respond to Jesus is the most important thing in life. Now, I don't want to give away a spoiler, because we're going to come back next week. Andrew Satch is going to open to us the next bit of Acts 2. But I think it's okay to give a little spoiler, because Peter gives his own spoiler in verse 21 when he was quoting Joel. Do you remember we saw it last week? Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So the spoiler is, there is the possibility of mercy and pardon. There is salvation for those who seek it. And I just want to close by thinking what a wonderful and remarkable truth that is. Think about this situation here. These people have just handed over God's son to be butchered. And they've discovered what they've done. And what should they do? Well, should they run and hide? Well, that's a bit silly. God is very good at hide and seek. That's not going to work. Should they try and make it up to God? Well, that's silly, isn't it? You know, they haven't stolen stationery from the cupboard. They've murdered the Lord of glory. What good is trying to make it up to God going to do? And yet there is wonderful grace and mercy, even for these people who killed God's son. And if that's true, there is grace for you and me as well. For you and me, who in all kinds of ways have ignored or defied Jesus' authority. And God doesn't just want to forgive us, wonderful as that is. He wants to give us a gift. We saw this already last week. God promises to send his spirit. God promises to send his very presence into our lives. And he promises to be with us and to change us into people that we were made to be. And I want us to just dwell on the great, rich mercy God has shown. It's unprecedented. It's unmatched. His kindness is extraordinary. Now, all we have done to contribute to Jesus' death, all we have done is contribute to Jesus' death. And all Jesus does is he returns that with an offer of life and hope. What a God we worship.